October 11th, 2009. It's Tom and Croc as usual, but we're also happy to be joined by David Adams, OS News owner.
Hello.
Aha.
Hi.
Okay. Right, sorry, we've had a number of Skype problems, but we don't really know where to start. We missed last week because Tom,
I was busy
you were
again,
busy.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, we do this in spare time, and if someone's off doing other things, then unfortunately we just missed the show. So sorry about that. But how's people's weeks been?
Well, mine's been fine enough.
I had an interesting week. I spent the earlier part of the week in the Silicon Valley area attending a demo day at Hewlett Packard that I can talk about a little bit. It was kind of interesting.
Uh-huh. It was all
paid for. Should I talk about it now?
It was all paid for, right?
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah, I definitely would classify it under the boondoggle characterization. In that that HP was having this demo day and they invited various people to attend it, all expenses paid. Now, of course, as a member of the new media, I now have to disclose when I take part in a boondoggle like this. Otherwise, I will be fined $11,000. So, pay for me to travel to the Bay Area to look at their servers.
Yeah, well, I got to mention about the review that I did of Morph OS. It was supplied to me by someone from the United Kingdom, a private person who, one of our readers, who supplied it to me and who paid for shipping to my end. So I got to, say it was like £11. I have to pay that back, but I haven't paid that back yet because PayPal is slow. So I got to mention that too right now before I'm, got like the FBI here in the Netherlands. So just pointing that out already. Okay, so good. It's ready to be shipped back right now, by the way. I'm going to put it in shipping tomorrow. So,
Yes, I think eventually making fun of this whole thing will wear off, but for now it's kind of funny.
Exactly.
Although, really, I don't think it's going to change a lot of things because it's only guidelines that are law and they're not exactly busting people's doors down because of their, shady backroom deals that happen in the blogosphere every day, day in, day out.
Yes. Definitely the corruption of bloggers is one of our world's most urgent problems right now.
Yeah, we can barely feed the world's population, so let's worry about all those people who get free stuff. That's it's very important.
But so I was the demo day. It was on a topic that was simultaneously interesting and extremely boring. that is to say, it was about Hewlett Packard's high end servers, specifically their Superdome server. But what made it interesting to me was that we spent a fair amount of time talking about HP UX. And as one of the bloggers who was there mentioned, What he found the most interesting about the discussion was the fact that HP UX was still available, which he had not been aware of.
Yeah, you really got to be some kind of weirdo to know that they still sell APX.
But we did talk a little bit about HP UX and OpenVMS.
Oh,
and. I discovered that there is one and only one reason why OpenVMS is still in production, and that is that there is at least one very large governmental organization. I got the impression that it was a secretive governmental organization, perhaps the CIA, that had a huge install base of VMS that it had no intention of migrating to any other platform, and therefore Hewlett Packard continues to support it basically for
and
that one.
Security for
account.
Obscurity.
And it never crashes, and still they're always wrong. Oh, sorry, I didn't say that. Sorry. That's
but I do actually have a soft spot for VMS because everything I know about the internet I originally learned on a VMS VAX system. And so in 1994, I had to start learning about Unix in order to use the internet, and it made me very upset because it wasn't as nice as VMS.
Don't say that too loud, because the people will come down and break your door. And...
Gosh, in 1994, I was learning about girls.
No, that is not true. The VMS fans will fall into formation. All of us, all of the silent millions, will fall into formation and defend our beloved platform.
I'm kind of wondering what I was doing in '94. I was probably still, you know, playing with toy cars and everything.
But so we got to learn about this Superdome server, which is quite cool, and its ultimate, most completed. Configuration. It's 128 sockets, I believe, and has some cool functionality, such as it seemed like everything was quintuple redundant. There were at least five of everything. There were actually 10 power supplies, so there were five redundant sets of power supplies and five fans and five separate storage subsystems and five, they were kind of like blades, except bigger than blades. They called them cells, but five separate processor cells. Or were there six? I guess whatever it is to add up to 128. But anyway, each processor cell kind of was able to be removed. And it was amazing. One of the amazing things about these Superdome servers was that they first released this product in 10 years ago in 1999, and since then they've made constant upgrades. You know, I believe the first processors were maybe 600 megahertz PA RISC processors, and as they keep updating it and eventually they move to faster PA RISC processors, and then Itanium processors, and now they're moving into the newest Intel processors. But you haven't had to, you know, basically everything is modular, and so many people are still using their initial hardware. I learned a term from this market segment that I wasn't really familiar with, but they were always throwing around this idea of the forklift upgrade. So and in fact showed some picture of not just forklift but crane upgrades where they would like literally take a section of the wall off of a building and bring and put this big machine in through the wall using a crane. And apparently it's quite a bit of a pain to install these systems, and so one of their big selling points is that you can just continually upgrade these systems without having to replace the cabinet. And so, you know, everything that you would need to upgrade it, you know, comes in a box that you can carry, and you carry enough of those boxes in there and start slotting them into their places, and everything works very nicely. But on the software, I wasn't particularly interested in the hardware because, you know, okay, it's super duper expensive hardware, but on the software side, they had some very interesting virtualization work that they've been doing. You know, and obviously their biggest competitor for this is the more common, you know, smaller, less amazingly expensive hardware. I believe that this stuff, you know, we're talking around $500,000 for one of these units. So, you know, what they're competing against is less expensive, you know, mid-end hardware, using something like VMware for virtualization. Whereas they have their own proprietary virtualization software that has some pretty nifty functionality when mated with, particularly with HPUX. So you can run multiple operating systems on this one machine. You can run HPUX, OpenVMS, Windows, or Linux, and various, I think at least there are three distributions of Linux that are supported on it. And you can run them simultaneously on one machine, and you can even partition or virtualize or create a virtual machine on the server that's actually electrically isolated from the other machine. So even if there's a hardware failure on one of the other virtual machines, your other virtual machine won't be affected by it. So it was some interesting stuff to look at.
Mm-hmm. I can certainly see that.
So that's my field trip report for the day. What else has been going on this week?
Well, that's technically the week before that. Right? Yeah,
we've got like 2 weeks, right?
The news item posted just after 2 weeks ago, week in review, is about Apple and Intel's Lightpeak technology.
I later on I found some reports. I didn't put them on West News. Maybe I forgot. I don't know. That after all, it wasn't really Apple that was pushing this. There are now all sorts of reports that it's just an Intel technology, and Apple just heard of it and kind of said, hey, look, that's cool, but it's still completely an Intel project, and it's not like that Apple came up with it and everything. It's more like Intel came up with it, was working on it, was working on optical connectors for a really long time. I mean, if you recall, the first USB 3.0 ports had, or specifications, also talked about including optical connections, so... It's kind of something that Intel's been working on for much longer, and of course it really the functionality that it has really appeals to what Apple usually wants. So I think it kind of went like Intel is working on this, and of course Apple and Intel are very cozy partners, so they probably share some research information among one another, and then of course Apple sees this whole Lightpeak thing and says, hey, look, we want that. Can you put some extra effort behind this? And what we know now is that there were some extra information about this week, I believe, or this weekend maybe even, that the first pre-production material will be coming out in November, and that this stuff might already appear in shops in spring of next year. So that would actually, and the person that said this was the company that actually made the ports for the demonstration that we saw. So this is not some weird rumor from some guy in a trench coat somewhere. This is from the company that actually made the hardware that was using this. And he says, well, we're going to have some pre-production stuff in November, and then next spring we'll probably be selling this on the market. So that pattern would actually fit in with the rumor that, or the entire report that I believe was Engadget, I'm not sure. Yeah, Engadget. It would fit in with the report that Engadget had, who say that at the end of next year, or at least the second half of next year, in the back-to-school period, that Apple will already have this stuff on their machines. So it could be. I mean, still, of course, seeing is believing.
But Apple famously deserves a lot of credit for pushing the adoption of USB by eliminating prematurely... other forms of bus connection,
including
or serial
their
connection,
own, you know, ADB as well, which they had to drop for all
that, which needed to go. But the fact that a million iMac or the iMac,
yeah,
I don't know what it was. Yeah, the iMac users had to go out and buy a bunch of USB peripherals, gave a big boost to the market, and I think that there's a sociological thing going on with Apple that makes it kind of unique in being able to kind of ram a new peripheral standard down everybody's throats, because number one, Apple fans are are notoriously forgiving of Apple's excesses.
Sure, I mean, if Apple were to reintroduce ADB and ditch USB, the Apple fans would still, you know, buy all that new stuff en masse. Doesn't matter.
Well, and partly because of their fervor, and partly because they have to. If you want to buy the new Apple hardware, then you just have to do what it, you know, you have to go along.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that the market is a little bit more it's a little bit more monolithic, I guess. It's a little bit more It allows that kind of thing to happen. I think the other The other aspect is that because Apple has not succeeded in making a lot of headway in the enterprise market, and you know you're dealing with consumers, it makes it a little more easier because you know a vendor like Dell, whose bread and butter is you know corporate IT departments, they have to be a lot more conservative, you know, or else you know they'll have big customers that will revolt. And the only way that a revolt among you know countless millions of individual consumers is going to happen is if you know you have to get some kind of organization together in order to stage any kind of meaningful revolt. You know, just look at the iPhone and people's inability to to force Apple's hand on the Apple's treatment of the developer community. You can't organize everybody together to stop buying iPhones, but you know, you get a big company like General Electric, for example. Let's say General Electric is a Dell consumer and Dell makes a move on hardware that GE doesn't like. They can start buying from Hewlett Packard, and all of a sudden Dell misses its numbers and it loses 5% of its stock value and everything else. So I think maybe a company like Intel that has something like Lightpeak that it would like to introduce to the marketplace, it wouldn't surprise me if they actually go and ask Apple to be the ones to try to popularize it for precisely that reason.
Mm-hmm. Makes everybody jump at the same time, I mean, it's like DisplayPort as well. Apple just suddenly out of the blue dropping DVI, going straight to display mini DisplayPort for that matter, which you know annoyed a whole lot of people because the new Apple Cinema Display won't work with older Macs unless you've got adapters and blah blah blah. And one of the benefits, I suppose, with this Lightpeak is that it's the same cable for everything. You can run screens across it. You can run USB. You can run anything over it because it accepts multiple protocols. So changing to Lightpeak will actually solve a lot of problems in the long run, especially as I was saying, I think with the MacBook Air, is that you could have one socket on it, but you can power a screen, a network connection, USBs, all off of that one connection.
Yeah, I mean, it can daisy chain it, so you can probably even have, like, on a single cable, have ad networking and video and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I would love for this technology to become really, really popular. So we don't have to worry about, you know, about what display connector we're using, and then have 10 million cables running all through the back of your computer. And because even, you know, even on an iMac, you still got even though it's probably a really clean machine, you still got a number of cables in the back. You got your networking, you got several USB cables, etc. So I mean, I would love for everything to come together into one shiny little port that emits some red light. I think it would be. Would be really cool. I really want this to become really, really popular. And if it takes Apple to get there, I mean, go ahead. Be my guest.
It's going to allow for thinner and lighter laptops, ultimately, and that's the way that, you know, things are going. But there will certainly be some pushing back against it. I mean, you've got the issue of with displays with HDCP and HDMI already being in well positioned, etc., and so on and so forth. So, I mean, we just have to wait until this stuff really actually does start shipping to see what happens. But I think it's a great idea.
And of course, I mean, the whole licensing situation and patents and everything, it should be as open as USB is. I mean, everybody can make a USB connector. Everybody can make USB equipment. You don't even need to be part of any standards body. You could, you know, like we see with Apple and Palm now, but you could, but it's not necessary. Anybody can make USB, and it doesn't really matter. And the only thing that you can't use is the stupid logo, so who cares about that one? So that Lightpeak would need something like that, too, to be completely open and free and cheap. Obviously, it needs to be cheap. You can't make the USB really cheap, and you can't have a really expensive connector burdened by licenses and patents. That will never be successful. So,
okay, let's move on and try and find something else. I think we just have to read through all these items, and then we can just say stop when it gets to something interesting. We've got browser makers unhappy with the ballot screen proposal. Anything worth there?
We're skipping one about Apple and unwanted software.
Oh, of course. Right, well, if you want to discuss that, because, I mean, gosh.
But, I don't know if anybody has anything to say about it.
Not
I mean,
specific
it's pretty,
to say. I mean, the whole situation with the Apple software update is dire as it is, but I don't think we'll be saying anything new by repeating it.
Yeah, exactly.
Another Microsoft Research operating system, Helios. I mean, this is quite interesting as far as, David, what you were talking about with the sort of virtualization stuff and things like that. How this, the Microsoft Research operating system... allows you to run. Oh, I don't know the specifics, so I've got to read the article. Is anyone else read this?
I didn't read it.
I wrote it. But
I still don't know what it says.
Yeah, but this is generally stuff that is, you know, I'll be easy to admit. I mean, I probably even wrote that down. This is stuff that goes way over my my head. I mean, I read the scientific article that's behind it, but it's still, this is stuff that, you know, is. I can vaguely get some idea of what they're trying to do, but I'm trying to refrain from making any really specific statements about it out of fear of being really, really wrong, you know, and this being a small project and everything, you don't want to say the wrong things, because a lot of people automatically assume that, you know, because they see letters on the internet that what I'm writing is true, but of course I can write just as much nonsense as everybody else. So I try to be careful with stuff like this and just generally copy whatever the scientific article says. So but what I found more interesting about this, so even though I may not understand all the specific details, that all this work that Microsoft is apparently doing on the research front end of operating systems kind of shows, at least I think, that they are really looking towards the future. They're not, you know, Windows NT is fine and it works and everything, but there's going to be a point where it's no longer, where it will no longer be enough. I mean, they hit that point with Windows 9X, and Apple hit that point with Classic. We call it Classic now, but with the old Mac OS. And at some point, you just got to, you know, make a clean break and start all over again. And Microsoft did that, you know, in the early 90s. And at some point, NT is no longer going to be enough. They have to come up with something new. And I think that's kind of what they're doing now. They don't...
So I was just saying that I was worried about the quality of the podcast.
We do apologize in advance. It's not going to be fantastic, but we'll just have to model through.
If our voices are coming through to your recording as clearly as your voice is coming through to my headphones, it's not going to be very good.
No, exactly.
My end, it's not been too bad, but David, you've been fuzzing out sometimes. We'll just have to make do.
Okay.
There's little we can do about it right this moment.
I was talking about something...
Yeah, you said don't, and that's where it froze and crashed.
Can you, like, rewind for a second? And
talking about the Microsoft planning for the future, really.
Yeah, okay, I'll just pick up on there, and then in the cutting and pasting, we can work something out there. Okay, so we are called disconnected there for a second, so I'm just going to try and pick up from my mind's eye where I was. I was saying something about Microsoft working on the future. Like I said, Windows NT is not going to serve Microsoft forever, and it's already, you know, technology-wise, it's already relatively old. I mean, it was designed in the very early 90s, and it was almost the first version released of Windows NT, 93, right? 94, somewhere around there. So it's already relatively old for as far as technology, as far as software goes. So there's going to be a point where they're going to have to transition to something new, especially... seeing you know, the rise in the number of processing cores in every machine, even like small netbooks these days almost already have multi-core processors in them, and I believe even some ARM chips for phones have multi-core stuff. So you'll have to have an operating system that's designed to handle all that stuff, and you can slap on some features to your existing operating system, you know, like Grand Central in Mac OS X Snow Leopard, but at some point you're gonna have to redesign, because I don't think originally kernels and operating systems were really designed, at least not home operating systems, were really designed for the kind of stuff that's being thrown at them now, like, you know, machines having 8 cores or even future machines even more. So you're gonna have to come up with something new, and I kind of think that's what Microsoft is doing right now. They're not working specifically on a replacement for Windows. They're more or less telling their research departments, look, we have a number of problems, and this research group is going to work on problem A, this research group is going to work on problem B, and you're going to focus your work entirely on that problem, and you know, and the end result of that is that one group comes up with Helios, the other group much earlier came up with, what's it called?
Singularity,
and then this other group comes up with Barrowfish, and I can assure you there'll probably be a number of more, there will be more projects going on right now about this. And then at some point, you know, when the water's really high, they'll say, look, these are good ideas. We're going to put stuff together, and we're going to put something, someone leading this program, and we're going to develop the next version, blah, blah, blah. So I said something like here that, you know, all these projects are not, you know, for Windows in 2013, but they're more like more about the operating system in general in 2020 or maybe even later. I don't know. I don't know what Microsoft's planning is. I mean, if you look at Mac OS X, because for the article that I published yesterday, I read a lot of all the old articles about the early developer previews and the betas and everything. And if you look at what Steve Jobs had to say when he first introduced Aqua and Mac OS X to the public, that they planned for Mac OS X to be the Apple's operating system for 10 years. And we're kind of creeping up on that, because he said that in 2000. So, you know, there's going to be some point, even not just Microsoft will have to replace the operating system, but Apple too. I mean, Mac OS X might seem all the rage right now, but at some point it's not going to be enough. I mean, it's going to be just like, you know, the classic operating system. It's going to run into problems. And you can throw some patches here and you can patch everything up like they did with Classic and like Microsoft did with Windows 98 and Windows Millennium Edition. But at some point, you know, it's you're out of patches and you're out of there are more holes than you have band-aids in your little toolkit. So you're going to have to come up with something new. And Microsoft's clearly working on that. And Microsoft is slightly more open than Apple about all this. So I'm sure Apple has some projects of themselves running there, but Microsoft, of course, has a massive research department where it does things like this, and they sometimes release their material, and sometimes even as open source, because I believe both, I'm not sure about Helios, but Barefish at least is released as true open source, and Singularity was under an academic license, so you could study the code but not use it for anything. So that's kind of interesting, I'd say. And it's, of course, yeah, continue.
So, software always lags hardware.
Yeah.
It always takes a while for the software to be able to truly take advantage of any hardware, you know, great leap in hardware. And then you have the other thing that's, of course, been going on is as hardware has been becoming more powerful, It's actually allowed software developers to be lazy by just throwing processor cycles at their problems instead of truly solving them. But I think that the big challenge in the software world over the next, I'd say, 10 years is going to be to truly be taking advantage of having you know, multi-core processors in every device, and to take advantage and you know, optimize that opportunity.
At least not getting things talking to each other as well.
What'd you say, Clark?
And at least not getting everything talking to each other as well, about networking, about communicating, you know, zero config devices being able to talk to each other. I think that's an important part of the future, is that one device should be able to freely talk to another without any configuration, just by being within range.
Yeah. Kind of what, you know, Apple has that now, and Windows 7 has it too, so I don't longer have to worry about my printer and everything. It's automatically shared. It's automatically, every machine in my network can access, every Windows machine at least, can access my wireless printer now, just because it's completely configured on my main desktop. Every other machine can access it too now, automatically. I don't have to do anything about it. And that's something that I used to really, really hate about about networking, but it's kind of getting off the track here. But what was I going to say? Yeah, I was going, I don't recall what I was going to say, so you guys can take over.
David, do you have anything else to add, otherwise I was going to move on?
I have an interesting project that, I mean, I can move on to a project that I've been fiddling around with.
Sure, yeah.
Good.
I actually, speaking of people lending hardware, a company called Next Window has arranged for Dell to send me an interesting machine. I don't actually know what the model number of this Dell is. It's the Dell Studio One, which is essentially Dell's answer to the iMac. It's an all-in-one widescreen PC. But the thing that it has going for it, and the reason that Next Window sent it, is Next Window makes touchscreen hardware.
Yeah, I see it on the website and now.
So this Dell Studio One has a touchscreen. And the reason I wanted to bring this up now is it's a perfect example of the software needing to catch up to the hardware. Because the touchscreen is very cool, although honestly, the truly useful applications for touchscreen and computing, a desktop computer is not the optimal. It is not the optimal environment for that.
This thing is beautiful.
But there are some kind of demo software applications that were included on this, a Microsoft Surface app and a few games that use touchscreen. And actually, the review of this that I'm going to do as a video. So I'm going to demonstrate, my kids and I are going to demonstrate some of the touchscreen apps on here. So that's a project that I'm looking into, and I guess a little hint of the conclusion that I'm going to bring is that a handheld device is both it's a device that makes more sense to use touch technology, and the touchscreen on this particular desktop device is not as crisp and responsive as the touchscreen on the iPhone, for example, which I would consider to be the one to beat. The iPhone has the best touchscreen on any device that I've ever used. So
it does, but this Studio One does have multi-touch, right? Because I'm looking at the website.
It does have multi-touch, and so a lot of the multi-touch gestures that you may be familiar with on the iPhone, you can do using this desktop machine.
Are you going to run Windows 7 on it, right? Because I'm seeing that it ships with Windows Vista, but
like, what's the point of that?
Oh no, it came to me with Windows 7 installed on it.
Oh, you already have it. Did you get the RET one, the RET model, or not?
It's white.
Ah, too bad. Sorry, I just kind of. I'm going to check out what this thing costs in the Netherlands if they already sell it here. Probably not, because we get stuff 10 years later than everybody else. So.
Yes, and unfortunately, I do have to send this one back.
I figured. <so. laughs> desktops, and they do sell all-in-ones here. I didn't even know that. Let me see.
But it's a very nice machine.
I can definitely see that one. Okay, you guys keep on talking. I'm just quickly...
I don't know what to say.
So moving on, what else is new?
What about this? I think Tom would probably want to talk about this, about the Autodesk. eBay seller in court over reselling software.
Yeah, let me get pick the story up. Where is it?
Well, while you're doing that, I can talk about the other project that I'm working on right now, is I had the company's smart home has sent me my order of lighting control modules for my ongoing series on home automation and using a personal computer as the nerve center of your home. And so over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be swapping out. These are mostly modules that replace either a light switch or an electrical outlet in your wall with a managed remote controllable outlet or switch, so that various lights in the house can be turned on and off remotely. And so my home security system, the Elk M1 home security / automation system that I have, will be set up with various scripts that allow me to that allow me to have lights turn on and off, or lights or other kinds of appliances turn on and off according to either buttons that I push or according to other inputs. So, for example, a motion sensor that I have hooked up to my security system could be used to turn a light on. Or, for example, when my garage door opens, I can have my exterior lights come on. Or when alarms go off, I can have the lights come on. So that's going to be a project that I'm going to be working on over the next couple of weeks. So if anyone has any questions about lighting control, or would like to see me try anything out, please don't hesitate to contact me.
Okay. So let's move to the Autodesk thing. You're gonna have the second item in front of you, though, Croc, if you're talking about this one, because the first item is obsoleted. So
Dutch sides with Werner slams Autodesk.
Exactly. Yeah, there was a bit of a confusion there, but I cleared that up in the article anyway, so I won't talk about that again. The case here is basically that Autodesk sells auto. What do you call it in English? I call it AutoCAD, but I'm not sure. That's that piece of software. Anyway, or AutoCAD, whatever.
AutoCAD, sorry.
AutoCAD, whatever. Anyway, that's what Autodesk is selling. And Brian W. Carver, or just let's call him Carver, he was... not Carver. The guy is called Werner. What's his front name? Let me see. I probably got his name somewhere, right? No, I just call him Werner. Anyway, he was reselling copies that he bought of AutoCAD, and he was reselling it on eBay to other people. And Autodesk didn't like that, and Autodesk ordered eBay to take these advertisements down. And eBay did, because they're kind of obliged to do that, because they can't really eBay, of course, can't risk any major lawsuits being sued against them. So they took the ads down. Werner didn't like that, and Werner sued Autodesk. And this case has been in the courts for a while. On a number of occasions, the courts have already sided with Werner, but Autodesk kept on, they kept on appealing to the case. But basically, what this is all about is that Autodesk claims that software is licensed and not sold, and because it's licensed, because they claim it is licensed, Werner could not resell his software because the license didn't allow it. Well, the judge made a final call here, and he made a very detailed call. He cited a lot of jurisprudence in the United States, and also a lot of proceedings from Congress.
So, those listening, David just dropped out the call with a fantastically unknown error. Let's see if we can get back in. Hello, David.
I'm back.
Ah, there we
Sorry
go.
About all this. I think we're just going to have to muddle through this, try and assemble some kind of show. I mean, that's my problem. You guys don't need to worry about it. I'll deal with that in GarageBand. I just want to... I think we're rambling a lot, and I would really hope that we can get onto a good subject, something solid, make our minds up.
Yeah, like what?
No. Well, there's Microsoft Access Works introduces Office 2010 starter with ads.
Oh, wait, let's get that one. Then you're going to have to cut out the stuff about Autodesk, by the way. I wasn't really, my English wasn't really up to snuff there anyway. let me see. Yeah, I've got the degree in English, but we barely talk in English, so. there we go. Microsoft Access Works introduces Office 2010 starter with ads. Okay, I wrote the item. One of you guys will have to introduce it. I already did all the work for you, so just talk.
Yeah, so if you've ever brought a machine from an OEM instead of actually building it yourself, you've probably had a whole lot of crapware loaded, preloaded on it, one of which, of course, is going to be Microsoft's venerable Works suite, which is a sort of... I wouldn't even call it a cut-down version of Office, because it's far more crippled than that, really. It's kind of like...
My first office suite.
Yeah, no, it was. It comes from a sort of 90s era set of ideas of having an integrated single suite rather than individual applications and some kind of
Bob.
Yeah, exactly. I think it comes from sort of the Microsoft Bob era of thinking, where you have a home screen and you go to different places in the application to get to places like word processor, spreadsheets. So Microsoft works acts in a monolithic kind of way. In fact, like OpenOffice, it can be said. Where you have the one executable one, everything is bundled into it and everything. And it's just very it's not even cut down version of Office. It is just a word processor, a spreadsheet, a database, a calendar, and other bits and pieces and everything. And that's been sold to OEMs for as cheap as $3 for them to stuff on their machines so that people have got something basic to write with. One of the heavy criticisms of Microsoft Works, not less its features set, is that it uses a proprietary file format which is not compatible with anything, including Microsoft Office itself. And so anyone who writes using Works has got these files that they can't email to people, that they can't open in anything else, and they can't convert to anything else. Not, well, it's possible, but it would be beyond the knowledge of the average user. So in sort of what could be seen as perhaps a good thing, Microsoft are ditching the workload of Microsoft Works and are going to be instead selling My First Office 2010 to OEMs, which will include, what did they say, Microsoft Word and Excel, but will also include adverts.
Yeah, and it's slightly cut down, so some features will be gone, but I didn't exactly say which features, so we don't really know that yet. Yes, it's got advertisements, and I have absolutely no idea where they want to put advertisements in the current Office user interface, because even what we've seen so far of 2010 is basically a slightly refined ribbon. So I have no idea where are they going to put those advertisements.
I know where they're going to put them. Hmm? They're gonna the Clippy is going to.
Yeah,
say them.
Someone's gonna say that.
It's I see you're writing a suicide note.
would you like the nearest gun shop?
Would you like to buy a firearm?
I see you're doing a review of Windows. Have you considered the following information? I don't think you're fully informed.
I see that you're Dutch. Would you like to go to the nearest coffee shop? No, I'm not.
See, now that would be cool.
It amazes me. I mean, it's good in a way that it is going to be Office 2010 itself, because that means that it will give people the compatibility with Office files if they're emailing to people or they're receiving files from other people. But I really don't understand where Microsoft get off with this idea of putting adverts in a piece of software that they are selling to OEMs who would rather do that advertising themselves and be making that money, and what contempt it shows for end users, not least.
Well, maybe what's going to happen is that the OEMs will be the one providing the advertisement. Mm. So that if you buy a machine from Dell, there'll be advertisements in there from Dell. That could be.
True.
And you know, and again, we don't know what they're going to do with. There's a video somewhere on Channel 9 where they detail what kind of ads and maybe even where they are positioned. But I haven't seen that video yet because I lost the link. So there is some information known about that. But
Microsoft is in kind of a difficult position here, because. And they've actually been in this position with Microsoft Office for some time now. You could make a case that it's been 10 years that they've been in this position. And the position is that Microsoft Office, that they are incapable of producing new features and functionality in Microsoft Office that anybody wants. I look back at the first version of Microsoft Office that I used, which was Microsoft Office, I believe 5.1 for the Mac, mm-hmm. which is a lovely piece of software, terrific word processor, the best word processor that you could buy at the time, I think. And I look at the features and functionality of that software compared to, well, the computer in front of me. I have a new Mac and I'm running, the latest version of Microsoft Office for Mac 2008. Honestly, I can't think of a single feature in this new version that I care about that the version that I used 10 years ago didn't have.
Actually,
that I used 15 years ago, excuse me. And so, you know, if Microsoft Office is going to come out with a trimmed down version of Office, unless they make it just arbitrarily awful like Microsoft Works, they're not going to be able to make it bad enough that it won't be a perfectly good word processor that everybody will be happy to use.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gets to the point of how much more stuff can you put into a word processor?
Well, it's not about how much stuff you can put into word processor. I think one of the problems with Microsoft Office being stuck in a ditch with its functionality is actually not what functions it has, but how Microsoft Word goes about it. One thing that I hear a lot from an older generation who worked as receptionists and typists and worked with computers, though not being technical users themselves, in the last 10 years, is that they actually preferred greatly the way that programs like Lotus and WordPerfect function. WordPerfect was a word processor for receptionists, for typists, and the way that Microsoft Office actually goes about writing a document is so horrendously bad and inefficient and not good for actual people who want to type things quickly. And Microsoft have always stuck to that, and because it's so ubiquitous now, we just live with that. But other Office suites, especially back in the day, were simply superior writing tools. And I think the problem with Office is that 2007 helps in that it exposes functionality, but doesn't really fundamentally change how you use Office operates, how it thinks.
You're talking about WordPerfect now, but have you ever used the traditional old blue WordPerfect in MS-DOS or not? Because that's what I was taught when I was really young in primary school. And I can tell you, it may have been advanced and it may have been better for typists, but it had a learning curve the size of Kilimanjaro. Seriously, it was impossible to learn. I was a kid, right? So I should have been easy to learn. But I also heard it from like my parents, who were old then and are still old. It was WordPerfect was very difficult to learn because everything was done via keyboard commands, right? And that took a lot of learning to get some sort of flow in your works. While it may have been easier to use once you learn all that stuff, it might have been easier to use. I mean, that's what a lot of people say about the command line interface, right? Yeah, it's a steep learning curve, but once you know everything, it's much easier. Yeah, well, that's great, but I think that in the end, Microsoft Office, especially 2007, that the learning curve is much smaller than if you would look at, let's say, a graphical Office suite. It's much easier to get into, much easier to learn than, say, something like the old-fashioned WordPerfect that a lot of people still love, but that was completely tied around keyboard commands. In fact, they had this little strip that you could place above your keyboard, and that would line up perfectly with the F keys and everything, with the function keys, so that you would know exactly what everything did. It was very difficult to learn, and it may have been once you've learned all the stuff, it may have been, you know, like faster and easier to use and more natural, but the learning curve was way too high. And I think
I was a big user of WordStar, which was a competitor to WordPerfect that was even more arcane. And I thought it was great, but still, when, you know, like I say, Microsoft Word 5.1 for the Mac, I consider that to be the best word processor, because all of those kind of issues of arcane commands and you know, lack of WYSIWYG, those issues were all pretty much solved by, let's say, 1989 or 1988 or so. And so since then, the advances in user interface for a word processor have to some extent been a step backwards, as somebody intimated earlier. You know, where, you know, the latest version of Microsoft Word is, it seems like it's always hitting me over the head with formatting. It's always making something double spaced that I want single spaced, and then I can't figure out how to change it back, and it's trying to format the document for me in a way that is extremely annoying and, moreover, is difficult to undo.
But you're talking about the Mac version, right? or
I'm talking about both the Windows and the Mac version, okay. which Microsoft has actually achieved a pretty good amount of parity in the annoyingness of both Office for Mac and for Windows.
Yeah, Microsoft Office really shouldn't be taken as the pinnacle of a good way of writing Office documents, especially how annoying Microsoft Word is and how nickery it is. And another good example is, say, Excel. Apple came out with Numbers, and which tries to change slightly the paradigm of spreadsheets by, instead of having a continuous sheet, you have tables, and so it makes all the formatting so many times much easier. Because I've been doing some spreadsheets recently, and I literally sit and wonder, how the crap do I know this? It's so utterly complicated and finickery to do anything in Excel. I'm just staggered at the fact that I even know this, and how anyone else is supposed to learn this. It's so frustratingly difficult and time-consuming to do any formatting or layout or just anything in Excel. Fantastic program, don't question it. Probably the best killer app of all time. But the paradigm is... Microsoft have been following the same paradigm for 25 years. If they're going to make any real big changes to Office, I think they've got to try and shift the paradigm a little bit.
But back to the, back to the subject at hand. So the problem that Microsoft has is that If they made a simplified version of Excel and Word, they're running the very serious risk that it would be better than the one better for the vast majority of the people who are their Office customers.
Why the ads are there, because it's the only thing that would annoy people enough that they would leave something that's very well functioning to get to the full version.
Exactly. I mean. The last thing that they want to do is cannibalize the sales of Microsoft Office, which I do believe is actually their most profitable product. So I can kind of understand the predicament that they find themselves in. I'm not very sympathetic, but I certainly understand it.
Well, I think that basically, if you look at where Microsoft is making its money with Office, I think most of the money will be made by companies, enterprises, and stuff like that that buy Office. And you can be dead sure about that. The license for this ad-supported version of Office will state something like only one computer, not allowed in businesses, or something like that.
Course.
It will definitely state something like that, because that way, because companies cannot afford to disregard licenses, which is end-user license agreements, which is something that every other sane person should discard. But as a company, you can't really afford to to take gambles like that. So, something like that will probably be in there to make sure that companies will buy the full big boy version of Microsoft Office, so that they won't lose.
Microsoft won't lose too much. Sell this directly to OEMs. This is not selling to Barbie shop.
Yeah. Anyway.
Certainly.
Yeah. Exactly. True.
I mean, and all of this. I mean, you could just, the answer to it is, or use OpenOffice for free.
Yeah. Or shove shards of glass underneath my fingernails. I completely detest. I probably shouldn't say this in the podcast and angry comments and whatever. But I detest OpenOffice. It's probably one of my most hated applications in the world. I hate it so much. it always messes up the formatting. The interface is archaically is archaic. I can't use it, especially now that I've grown accustomed to the ribbon. I mean, I really can't go back to OpenOffice.
OpenOffice just tries and follows the Office paradigm badly.
Yeah. So now they're going to come up with a ribbon of their own, which will probably suck more than the Microsoft version. So it's no. I mean, I shouldn't. What I even hate the most about OpenOffice is that it starts up so slowly and it formats documents so slowly. So when I'm using when I was working on my thesis, which I completed a couple of months ago. You've got like all these different versions of your documents. You've got different parts of your thesis in different documents. And sometimes I just really need to quickly load up a specific part, edit that, and close it again. And, with Office 2007, a Word loads instantly. I mean, I double click on the document and it's right there. I mean, not just the application, but the document itself as well. And that's really something that you'll, that might not seem all that important if you occasionally edit a document. But if you're working for months and months on end on numerous documents, something like that, the startup times and the time it takes to load up a document, that's going to add up at some point. And OpenOffice just, is no match for Microsoft Office in speed. That's really weird.
Let me ask a question here. Does anybody know of a word processor that has full version control?
Version control.
Because that just occurred to me. I mean, here I am talking about how Microsoft Office hasn't made an important feature addition in 15 years. And I'm thinking, okay, here's a feature that everybody could use. If you were to add a full version control interface to a word processor, we now have almost unlimited amounts of disk space. I don't care if my important document is taking up, is taking up 1.5 gigabytes. To space.
Well, I'm
I wouldn't mind having at least some database of every edit that I've ever made to this document that I can browse through.
There is options for that. You've got changes tracking.
I've got my. You can do track
changes. And there's an option changes. Also for Word to save each version as well.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Because I was gonna say I would be surprised if Office didn't have that. I've never tried to use it, but I just was just having a flash of insight
the
there about
that.
Yeah, I'm loading up my thesis right now, the final Word version of it, and I'm trying to see if there's anything in here. I didn't put anything. I didn't enable any options, so I'm just browsing through the.
See, my ignorance of the intricacies of Microsoft Office. I suppose I can say that. What I use for word processing is I use the Mac application BBEdit, which is a text editor, but it has spell check and it has features to facilitate HTML conversion. But when I write, even when I'm writing a very long document, I just like to write it in plain text. And then if I want to cut paste it or convert it into Microsoft Word later on, I can. But I just prefer to work in plain text, and that's just because I'm a nerd.
I can kind of see that. Well, I'm trying to browse through the options here, and there is a option to compare two versions of the same document. You combine revisions from multiple authors into a single document, so I'm sure there's some stuff in here.
Yeah, I've used the revision control, for collaborative documents, and there's some good stuff there, but
if you think
about what's the most important feature that any word processing document can have, and I would have to say it's making sure that no matter what happens, you don't lose your work.
Yeah, exactly. Autosave.
There are more important features than that, because how many of us have lost a good portion of work at some point in our computing careers.
I'm raising my hand.
Due to user error or due to some kind of technical glitch.
Yeah, considering that I was using a college, we had Windows 98 computers running novel netware with Office 2000 on it. So that was like the most unstable collection of software you could possibly put on one computer.
Oh, what do you think of Mac OS 9?
I mean, I implicitly press Control S at the end of every sentence.
I know that feeling.
Section
I know that.
My
feeling.
Brain devoted to it.
I really know that feeling. Oh, okay. We should probably move on to something else, right? Okay. Let me see. What else do we?
Morphos. Did you want to talk about that? Because you've just recently completed your Morphos review.
Morph OS. Now, what should I? Is there anything to add here? Well, maybe that. Maybe something that I want to say about this is a little bit more in general of platforms like this. So we got like small platforms like Amiga, like Morph OS, and stuff like that. If you were to kind of put everything, if you were to kind of like label everything, you would have what I would consider the big three. So you have Mac OS X, you have Linux distributions packaged as a whole, and I kind of add BSD distributions in there too. People can hit me with sticks if they're angry about it, but kind of like the Linux BSD group.
Mainstream Unix.
Yeah, let's put it somewhere. So you got that, you got Windows, you got Mac OS X, and you got the mainstream Unix department. And then all the way at the bottom, you got like small projects like Syllable and ReactOS and everything. But there's something in between. There's a group of operating systems that sits in between that still has some form of commercial support, and there are still commercial companies making software for those platforms. And you've got, like, the Amiga is one of those. So Amiga, MorphOS, and to some degree, Aros as well. And these are kind of like the last remnants from an era that's already sadly that kind of died. I wrote about that in my in the Haiku article. That kind of this concept of having a lot of different platforms, a lot of different operating systems, who are not just superficially different, but who are really, really, really different from each other. That kind of died the moment B-Inc went under in 2001, and it's never that market never recovered, right? The market kind of shifted towards like the mobile space, where you've got a lot of different offerings, and everybody can enter and leave and whatever. But when you look at the desktop side of things, it's pretty much there's no real you can't really come into the desktop market anymore and make something new and gain a following. I think BOS was the last one to do it, and before that you had platforms like OS2, you had the Amiga, you had like, a number of others. What?
RiskOS.
Oh yeah, RiskOS, yes, exactly. Mostly the United Kingdom, of course. But those platforms are mostly gone now, and they're, you know, trying to get by on the sidelines, kind of getting by on the on the mercy of what you call it, nostalgia. So you got RiskOS still going in corners of the world, and you have a few stubborn people who still use the Amiga or MorphOS. And I find it kind of sad that, you know, the first thing that people ask you when you review something like MorphOS or something like AmigaOS, and the first question they always ask is, "What's the point?" Right? What's the point? We got Windows. You won't stand a chance anyway. It's all pointless. Why bother? Why do that? And I find it very cynical and very sad that the first response, even from geeks, you know, from like people who should be interested in this stuff, the first response is usually something along the lines of, who cares? They don't stand a chance anyway, so just forget about it. Let's just use Linux, you know, like something like that. I think that's kind of really sad.
And well, you know, let me bring up this. This may be a somewhat imperfect analogy, but let me bring up an analogy. If you want to have a bicycle, you can buy a bicycle, or you can make a bicycle, and most people will just buy one, but some people will make one. But if you make a bicycle, generally you're going to be buying aluminum tubing or steel tubing that is manufactured in a factory that produces this tubing. And you can make your own aluminum tubes that you can then weld together as a bicycle. But if you're already going to the trouble of building the bike, to go to the trouble of making the tubes, or you can even take the analogy one step further, where you're actually refining the aluminum from ore.
Yeah, I've got
to. You get to a point where it's just stupid. Where the only reason to do it is you know, if you're making some kind of a point. You know, in fact, I remember reading on the internet a couple of months ago about some guy who was trying to create some kind of consumer good by literally like mining every he was going to actually mine every single raw material and refine it in order to create, I don't know, a radio or something like that.
He's a girlfriend.
But he's doing it as, you know, to make a point about how we take things for granted. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to build an operating system, I kind of see it like that. Some people are doing have done and are doing very interesting things by taking existing operating system kernels such as one of the BSDs or Linux, and building an operating system on top of that. And I in my analogy is like learning to weld and making a bicycle using tube and metal billet stock that you purchase from somebody who creates various types of aluminum stock, and welding that together and making something new and interesting. But it just isn't necessary for you to be going out there and refining aluminum from ore, or going out there and creating the specialized machinery that it takes to make industrial scale aluminum tubing. And it's because that infrastructure is in place Now, you might be able to make a superior tube that would be slightly better than the one that you can buy. But the amount of effort that you would have to go to do that, you know, very few people are going to find that that's worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's kind of where the operating system world is. Is that there's enough raw material there, you know, you can go down to the corner store, so to speak, and buy some very good raw material that you can use in order to build your operating system from. And you don't have to write a kernel. You can, but you don't have to. And does it make more sense to focus on making improvements around the margins of the state of the art rather than going back and trying to start from scratch? And, you know, I think we can lament the fact that people aren't starting from scratch anymore. And I think it's lamentable because you're not going to make any earth-shattering innovations by starting with an existing kernel.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But on the other hand, if you take a few steps back and look at it and you can say, look at how accessible it is now for somebody with just some good ideas to make a really usable operating system. And some of the stuff that they don't want to really have to worry about, such as device drivers and some other things, they can focus on other types of innovation that in the long run may be more useful.
WebOS. I'm kind of thinking about WebOS right now, just taking Linux and putting on a, fairly...
Precisely. So you look at Moblin, you look at Google OS, you look at, these other operating systems that are going to be built on, you know, they're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah, I was
going to
say. Mm-hmm.
And, so there's two ways of looking at that. And maybe hopefully someday somebody will figure out, some lunatic will decide that they do need to start from scratch and they will create something that revolutionizes computing. I hope that those lunatics are out there. Maybe they're listening to this podcast.
No, there should be coding.
Don't give up, lunatics.
No. And stop listening and go coding. That's kind of all I wanted to say about.
That's too traditional. We're having to invent a whole new paradigm of computer interface and how to operate computers. It's not thinking enough out of the box.
Uh-huh. Okie doke. Is there anything else that somebody would want to say about MorphOS specifically, or?
I don't know a great deal about MorphOS. I mean, how closely does this track Amiga? Is it compatible with Amiga binaries? Is it?
Yeah, it's basically the Amiga but slightly different. Now there are some other. It had from the start because it used a more advanced kernel. It had, especially when it first started, It already had like protective memory, and it already had virtual memory, and it already had multiprocessing and all that stuff that the Amiga didn't have. The Amiga OS 4 got some of this stuff later on in its development cycle, and but it's all turned off, obviously. So it is different, but if you start using it, you'll see that it's very much resembles Amiga OS 4. But there are some differences here and there. Like I said in the review, the developers behind MorphOS are trying a little bit harder to make the default installation more accessible to. I'm calling in, but it's not working, I can assure you.
No, we're getting a ring.
Oh, there we go. Hello.
Hi.
We're back.
Hello.
Okay, good.
Anyway. So I'd like to make a report on a user interface problem.
Mm. Okay.
So as the listeners may or may not know, I've been recording this podcast on my iPhone using Skype, and I've discovered a serious problem with the iPhone, and that is. When I get either a text message or a notification from my calendar reminding me of something, it disconnects me from Skype. That is really annoying.
Oh, that's what you get for buying such a
Chromium operating system.
I'm gonna stop talking now. I really shouldn't talk about the iPhone anymore because I'm afraid my house will get pillaged. It's
and I think it's because of the little sandbox that Skype has to work in. You know, whenever one of the dominant apps takes over, it doesn't close the Skype app. It just disconnects whatever the call I'm on.
Oh, that's but, completely useless. Sorry, that's really annoying. You should have bought a Palm Pre. I'm not. Is there actually a Skype client for WebOS? Not yet, right? Probably not yet.
How
anyway,
do I access the audio hardware and everything? Does the API support that? I don't really know.
Of course it does. Of course it does.
Okay.
Yeah. It's completely off topic, but there's a lot of misconceptions about the. We've got a topic on Palm. Wait. Let's get it. That's a really important one. We should talk about that one. It's good that I'm reminded of that. Where is it?
It's about WebOS development. Of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. We should talk
right,
about
yes,
that one.
Important.
Yeah, I can. So I can. It's kind of my smooth transition into the Palm. No, but I want to talk quickly. Want to say something about the APIs and the SDK. A lot of people assume that because it uses web languages that you can't really do anything with it. You can't access the hardware and everything. That's not true. Yes, it uses web languages, but it uses those web languages in relatively the same way that any other platform uses C or C Sharp or whatever. You can use the web languages, but the hardware is exposed to using these web languages. So you got access to the audio, you got access to all that stuff, you got access to blah 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 blah. It's just that the one thing that you do not yet have access to is the 3D chips or the 3D capabilities of the Palm Pre, and there are some hints that they're working on that one. So
that's a tricky one to solve because of just having the right API for it. I mean, technically, this is already being solved by other companies with the WebGL stuff that's gone.
Yeah,
into.
Exactly. They hired a WebGL developer, even if I'm not
mistaken.
No, that's not true. They put out an ad very early in the year, a number of ads about wanting OpenGL developers regarding the web Palm. So that's basically WebGL, obviously. So that's kind of what.
You know, a few months ago, I wrote an article for OS News about Rhodes, which is a development framework for a cross-platform mobile development framework.
Yeah,
and that's a similar situation. They use the web app tools. So for example, you can write an app using Ajax and PHP, but then it converts it into a native app. That'll run on multiple mobile platforms.
Uh-huh.
So, there's some interesting stuff going on there on various platforms as the technologies for creating mobile apps become more sophisticated and as the number of people out there who are comfortable working in those environments more and more it seems like they are displacing the traditional desktop development environments.
Well, now we've got the absolute joy that even though Adobe can't get Flash in the browser on the iPhone, we can now Flash developers can now port their crap to the actual iPhone natively.
Yeah, well,
that's just dumb.
Well, there is one thing that I wanted to say about that though, because I hate Flash as much as the next guy, but. Adobe demonstrated this new mobile Flash version thing on the Palm Pre actually, and I was I thought it was very remarkable about how fast and how responsive Flash was on the Palm Pre, and even that he had multiple cards open. So that's for those that don't know the Pre, that's multiple applications open using Flash. So a couple of games, a couple of YouTube videos, and it could switch between them no problem. And when you would go into card view, so you would see all your cards and all your applications, the video would automatically stop playing and everything. So I was kind of surprised because I really hate Flash and I think it's a slow piece of crap that needs to die. But at least that mobile version, at least the version on the Pre, I haven't seen any.
You're
other
getting
versions.
A bit confused about versions of Flash. That's the actual Flash plugin, you could call it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
No, we're talking about what Adobe have announced for CS5 is that you'll be able to compile Flash into a native binary for
iPhone,
not an actual runtime.
Okay.
But there's, I mean, there's issues with that. I mean, it means that the Flash developers who are already happy with their development environment can continue to be using that and pumping out their stuff. But it's got the drawbacks that it doesn't have access to UI kits, so they have to do all the UI manually. And I mean, it's probably only good for sort of games and porting what games are already there. And I still can't understand why you'd want to spend $1,000 on a suite when you can use Apple's SDK, which is free and comes with it.
A better version of Bejeweled, maybe. That would be totally worth it. That, or Peggle, maybe even.
If yeah, they, but I mean, they're perfectly capable of doing that natively rather than having to use a Flash runtime for it. In fact, they don't use Flash. It's ActiveX, what PopCap use.
Oh, yeah, true. Yeah, you're right. So anyway, we were talking about the WebOS, right? And Palm. What they Palm has always been about the Prey and about the WebOS relatively open. They more or less confirmed that they had no problems with the whole homebrew community that set up its own installers and their own applications you could download and install outside of the app catalog. Palm didn't really have a lot of problems with that, and but they never made it official. And the official wording of the SDK agreement still said, in a very vague kind of way, that it wasn't 100% clear about whether or not Palm approved you selling or distributing your applications outside of the app catalog. And recently, two people from Mozilla joined Palm as employees. What are their names? Okay, I'm going to kind of pronounce this one. Ben Gilbraith and Dion Almir, that's what it is. Dion Almir. They came over from Mozilla, and obviously Mozilla being very much into the whole open source thing, basically being entirely about nothing but open source. Palm instigated some changes in a development platform. So the first thing is that they officially blessed distributing your applications outside of the app catalog. So all you have to do is send in your application, and then Palm will send you back a URL from which you can, in that URL you can distribute it over Twitter or on your blog and whatever, and people click that and the application will be downloaded over the air towards onto your Prey. There won't be any form of review or approval processes and nothing. It's just there and that's it. On top of that, they also kind of made the WebOS a more, of they made the app catalog a more favorable platform for open source developers, because while proprietary developers will still have to pay €100 per year, as well as dollars. I'm sorry, they still have to pay $100 per year for the admission fee and $50 per application. Open source developers do not have to pay this, at least not for open source applications. And the last thing that they did is that all the analytical data that Palm has collected and is collecting about usage, about the phone and everything, they'll open that up to developers as well, which is something that the competition isn't doing. Well, Android is probably doing it, but I'm not sure. But it's something that the competition does not do. So it's kind of a three strikes in a row, I'd say. I mean, it's three good things that of increasing importance that are really welcome, I'd say.
Absolutely. And I suppose Palm have been under some pressure from carriers as well, who certainly would not like this sort of thing, because carriers don't want that.
Exactly.
So it's impressive that they've managed to pull this off at all. And I think that opens up a lot of possibilities with the platform. I would certainly consider developing for it. I'm not a C++ programmer, and so if I wanted to develop with the iPhone, I'd have to learn a whole new technology, not least the absolutely horrible conditions that developers live in for iPhone development in Apple's basement, whipped and chained or something, I don't know. Whereas this is web technologies. Well, I can do that. And so can many people. And plus the fact that you can just distribute in a completely open way on your own website and set your own rules about how you sell something and everything. It's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I really do hope that the moment that I finally get a Prey, that there will be someone out there who makes a nice OS News application for the WebOS that kind of like puts all their content there, so you don't have to use the browser and everything. It's kind of like an open invitation to everyone to do it completely for free, because I got nothing to offer you. I'm poor. But
just redesign the site to work better with the browser. You need a native app for it. Well, other than if you want to do some really fancy stuff.
Exactly, and I want fancy stuff. No, it's, I'm just kidding. It's, but yeah, I think this is whatever way you look at it, this is good news, and this is something that.
But bad news for the carriers.
Bad news for the carriers, but nobody
cares. But that, dumb pipes.
Yeah, but that's kind of the thing. Bad news for the carriers, but it's bad news for the carriers in the United States because the carriers that I have here, they don't care what you do. I mean, I've got, you know, it's no problem here to in the Netherlands to install whatever you want on your phone. And if you want to install a, you know, a VoIP application, they're not going to care. I mean, it's, I find this whole concept of carriers completely dictating what your phone can and cannot do. And then using companies like Apple to get there, I find that such an alien concept. I mean, I've been a subscriber to the Dutch T-Mobile network for God knows how long, and before that, I used the precursor to Vodafone in the Netherlands. It was I kind of forgot what it was called back then, but anyway, I just don't understand that whole concept. I've just got a phone, and I've you know I switch phones about once a year, and I can install whatever I want on those phones, and you know, and my T-Mobile's not going to care. I can install Skype on my phone. I can install whatever voice, you know, whatever VoIP application I want. And if it uses a lot of data, well, you know, I mean, in the end, I'm the one who's paying for the data. So, you know, who cares?
Well, you know, they do care. The carriers don't want to become dumb pipes, and they want to be able to have some kind of. They want to be able to be seen as adding some kind of value. And you know the difference between phone carriers in one place or another is that in some places they have not been successful in staving off the trend of just being dumb pipes, and I think it's inevitable that at some point they're all going to have to capitulate and just focus on differentiating themselves in service coverage and customer service.
No, and pricing.
And not differentiate themselves with various kinds of value adds and what kind of phones are available on their network, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the way it still is.
But the fun thing...
And they're going to fight it tooth and nail.
Yeah, which is kind of weird because here in the Netherlands, we had the same situation, but that was like 10 years ago. And then... We have our own little, you know, oversight committee for a communications market called the Opta, and they are, you know, partly a governmental institution, and they kind of ordered the carriers to seize all these, you know, these back alley deals and all that stuff. And what that the end result was that they had to compete on price, and you can see that because they've got no other means to control their customers. You are free to move around. You're free to, you know, of course, if you sign a contract for a year, I mean, that's actually an actual real contract. It's not an end user license agreement, but actual contract because you need to sign the damn thing. So, you know, then you're tied to your carrier for a year and you can pay a fee to leave. But after that year, you're free to go wherever you want. You can take whatever phone you want. You can use whatever phone you want. And that's all because.
Thank goodness I live in a country that respects freedom and not some hippie country like the Netherlands, so I don't have to live under that kind of regime.
No, but what I was going to say about pricing, the end result is that they had to compete on, well, we're a small country, so the coverage is, you know, the coverage is pretty good anyway. So they had to compete on price. And what's the end result? The end result is that mobile phone, you know, like contracts here in the Netherlands and data contracts are ridiculously cheap compared to, you know, if I see pricing information in foreign countries and especially in the United States, I just kind of facepalm and you know, and
it's not,
how
it's
expensive and how much money you guys have to pay abroad for all your stuff. And I can have an unlimited data contract here for €9.50 a month. It's unlimited data. No, and like speeds of, I don't know the speed from the top of my head, but unlimited 3G data for €9.50 a month. And I'm looking at whatever the, you know, AT&T offers for the iPhone. It's like, what is it, $50 or something per month? What is it?
Well, the data is, I think the data plan is $30, but you can only sign up for the iPhone data package if you have a voice package that's a certain size. I think the minimum you can get with voice and data together, I think the minimum you can pay on the iPhone is over $50. It's maybe $59.
So. It's not so bad in the UK. I mean, it's not as bad as America, and it's not as good as how Tom has it. In the UK, it is a very frantic market here, and the pace of things is crazy, and that all of the carriers are on just a massive branding mission, as that's their only way to get anywhere. And here, unfortunately, without proper regulation, you can sign up for contracts, and they are happy to give you try and sweeten the deal with things like a free PS3 or Xbox 360 and everything, and they'll give you ridiculous amounts of stuff free, other than the fact that you'll be paying more for the contract, so that by the time you finish paying in a year or two's time, you will have paid more than what the free gift was worth in the first place. But it's immensely competitive here, and people are expected to haggle, really, because the carriers are literally falling over themselves to get you as a customer.
Well, I can tell you that here in the Netherlands, the iPhone could have been a lot more popular than it already is. It's not, I don't think it's that much of, not that much of a success here as it is in other countries in the world. And the reason for that is that it's completely tied to T-Mobile. And that's a concept that we just don't understand. I mean, in the Netherlands, you can cherry pick whatever you want. You can say, I want this contract and I want that phone, and nobody's going to stop you. You won't even have to deal with any of the carriers, because you can just go to a retail store, to a phone retail store like Phonehouse or whatever, and they'll mix and match whatever you want. I want that phone, and I want a really cheap phone, and I want an expensive contract. I want a cheap contract and an expensive phone. And they've got like these huge tables where they like where you can mix and match everything, and it's and I can think that's kind of one of the things that is holding. I'm not sure, I don't know the sales figures of the iPhone here, so I'm just kind of talking out of my bum here, but I think the iPhone could have been a bigger success here if they didn't tie it to T-Mobile. So it's that's kind of the complete opposite situation, of course.
So, I mean, the American market has got a long way to go to really level out the playing field for users and developers too.
Yeah, it's I find it kind of archaic, but that's just me. Anyway, okay, is there anything else we should talk about?
I think we should perhaps wrap this up. Well, not least, I'm already late for dinner anyway, so...
Yeah, same here. I'm hungry.
anything you wanted to add, David? Any last things?
No.
Okay.
Things are good.
We apologize for the poor quality here. I reckon it's just Skype crashiness. Not least that you're on an iPhone, actually. That's really changes the mix. Anyway,
yeah,
okay.
Maybe. Yeah, no, never mind. Continue.
Okay, I was going to say. Right. Thank you all for listening. And emails, if you'd like to email us, please send your questions to osnews- I know we've changed it to mobile. It's just crew@osnews.com. crew@osnews.com. And you can follow us on Twitter, although what we say on Twitter really doesn't have anything to do with OS News. I'm at twitter.com/KROC.
And I'm at /TomHoward. And
David Adams
doesn't
use a computer. He's actually speaking to us using...
No, if someone wants to follow me on Twitter, I'm David_Adams, although I don't really talk about OS News stuff on there very much, so
no.
Be warned. But I also don't put pictures of my cat on there either. I just, you
know. Oh, I don't do that either. I just talk a lot of nonsense. But anyway, it's a
rant. All right, thanks everybody. Okay. And we'll see you all next week, hopefully.
Bye bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye bye.